It is 8:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. When Sandinista Daniel Ortega won election to the presidency of Nicaragua in 2006, a lot of the U.S. left celebrated this as part of a wave of left-wing victories in Latin American politics. But by April of this year, Ortega's presidency was cause for mass demonstrations inside his own country. The proximate cause was an executive order that would have cut pension benefits. Nicaraguans flooded the streets. Police fired live ammunition in the course of dispersing them. Dozens died. And in short order, the executive order on pensions was canceled, but the protests did not stop. As of today, demonstrators are operating more than 120 barricades in the streets of Nicaragua. By the count of Agence France-Presse, 137 of them have been killed in the course of demonstrating. And now the U.S. government is starting to respond. On Friday, it started imposing visa restrictions on members of the Ortega government, quote, involved in human rights abuses. Joining us to make sense of all of this is Professor Mirna Santiago. She teaches Latin American history at St. Mary's College of California, including the history of the Sandinista Revolution. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, big picture, how did the person who came into power as the head of a popular left-wing political party wind up being the target of mass demonstrations?
I think one of the kept secrets, if you will, of what happened to Daniel Ortega from 1990 when he lost the elections to Violeta Chamorro at the end of the Sandinista Revolution, or that marked the end of the Sandinista Revolution, till the Daniel Ortega that got elected in 2007, is that he was clearly doing a lot of thinking over that period of time, clearly very involved in the politics. But I think that some of the lessons that Daniel Ortega drew from the missteps or the losing of the Sandinista Revolution were largely three, and he put them into action. One of them was that you needed to get rid of the opposition on the left or keep it under very tight control or demobilize it if at all possible. Two, you needed to stay on the good side of the private sector so that you wouldn't have the kind of economic disarray that a private sector in opposition to the government could bring about. And three, in Nicaragua, socially, you needed to figure out how to make nice with the Catholic Church. And I think Daniel Ortega did those three, has been doing those three things very well until April of this year.
Well, wait a second. If you are repressing the grassroots left, making nice with business and making nice with the Catholic Church, are you still a left-wing political party?
Not in my book, but but again, I think that's one of the ones. Because the fourth part of that is that he continued, certainly since he came to power, he did continue to have a progressive discourse, if we will, like a rhetoric that was largely and much more recognized as sort of populist, as we would call populist today, anti-imperialist for sure. But the fact of the matter is that in, you know, those 20 years, the intervening 20 years between the fall of the Sandinistas in 1990 and the return of Daniel Ortega to presidency in 2007, Nicaragua went through a really radical restructuring of the economy, a neoliberal restructuring, probably only comparable to what Pinochet did in Chile in, you know, in his years in power after 1973. And Daniel Ortega did not change anything of that part of the structure of the government when he came to power in 2007. He was busier trying to figure out how to control the different political parts of the country, the National Assembly, so that everything that he would do or that he could do would be legal, the dismissal of all the old historical Sandinista figures who didn't agree with him, in subtle ways, this kind of more sort of soft repression against people that he felt might compete with him, and then the people that openly disagree with him. He started getting rid of all of them, but at the same time, he allowed and continue to develop this neoliberal approach to the economy, including the opening of more zona franca, so that maquiladoras could set up shop in Nicaragua. I mean, the infamous example of the interoceanic canal that was going to be built by the Chinese government.
I'm going to translate. These are zones that are exempt from many taxes and regulations that the rest of the country is not.
Absolutely.
And they're meant to draw foreign direct investment.
Yeah, direct investment. Most of them are sweatshops. And environmental laws don't apply, labor laws don't apply, but they bring in investment and they leave a little bit of money in the shape of salaries, and it's all for export. But the conditions there are not anywhere near ideal. But that was the way in which Nicaragua could reinsert itself into the international economy and create more jobs, right? Yep. These are job creation schemes.
There's a question that perennially comes up with populist leaders in charge of poor countries, which is how much room to maneuver do they have? They're often dependent on borrowing money from abroad, so they can't afford to scare off creditors. They are often highly import dependent in one part of their economy and highly export dependent in another part of their economy, so they can't afford to sour trade relationships. So, I mean, how much of what you're describing that Daniel Ortega pursued after he got back into the presidency was something he could have actually avoided?
That's probably the $6 million question or $10 million question. Depends on how you want to look at it. I think there's a difference between, you're absolutely right, right? The room to maneuver is very small. And Nicaragua ended up in 1990, and then in the post-neoliberal era, one of the really poorest countries, competing with Honduras in terms of the level of destruction that the Contra War happened. I think the objectionable part here is not so much that that the situation is so difficult and was so difficult even for Daniel Ortega upon returning to government. It is the level of deceit and the level of open lies that then he has been operating under to try to cement his own hold on power. Mind you, the situation was going to be difficult enough, but when you are practicing a political praxis that is so devoid of any real democracy, and you still call it revolutionary, and you still present yourself as a leftist and as a person that it has, you know, the interests of the Nicaraguan people at heart. And if you look at the actions that he's doing, and they are so clearly not along the same lines, I think that's what so many Nicaraguans are reacting to now. You know, the fact that Daniel has presented himself through all these years as a champion of the Nicaraguan people, but it really is only rhetoric. It has not been in the practice. What he's been able to offer the Nicaraguan people and why they have continued to vote for him is that the key area of maneuverability that he did have was this slush fund that people talked about that he was getting from Venezuela at the time, you know, with the close relationship that they had, that Daniel Ortega had with Hugo Chavez and the exchanges that Nicaragua was able to make, you know, for oil, et cetera, et cetera. But Daniel did have a slush fund that came directly from Venezuela that was not part of the national budget, which right there tells you it is going to be subjected only to the way in which he decides to spend it. I mean, there isn't anything more undemocratic than the way when you spend the meager budget that you have. And what he was using it for was really for patronage, right?
Not broad social benefits.
Not really broad social benefits, yes. It was spent on a number of different programs. Nicaragua copied the Brazilian Zero Fome project, you know, to try to keep hunger down with basic foodstuffs and materials for people who were really at the very bottom of the social pyramid. And then the rest of the stuff was, some of it was spent on not so much on social programs, but some stuff on infrastructure. And then some was spent strategically, either in populations or in areas that would then provide support political support for Daniel, or else it was spent in people that were already supporters of Daniel. So like, you know, in the very old style of Latin American politics of patronage and clientelism, right? And
that,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yes. And that is not... That's not democracy, right? That much less revolution, right? If you are supposed to have the concerns of all the people at the same time, because then he was not having that slush fund allowed him not to touch the rest of the structure, the rest of the neoliberal economics, where Nicaragua ended up having, you know, millionaires that not even had never been seen in history before, and a great deal of freedom for the private sector to do whatever it wanted in very close relations with the Nicaraguan government and with laws that supported their interest. And there is no way to add more flexibility to the economy in that neoliberal project.
We're speaking to Professor Myrna Santiago. She teaches Latin American history at St. Mary's, including the history of the Sandinista Revolution. She's, in fact, at work on an oral history project on the history of the 1972 earthquake that contributed to the fall of the Somoza dictatorship. We've talked about the Ortega government and why it's pursued the policies it has. What we've not yet talked about is the protesters. Who are they? What sectors of society have they been drawing from?
By and large, this has been a surprise for everyone. But it is a very young group of people. It really did start amongst the youth who originally came out into the streets in very small numbers to support the elders who were upset about the fact that their Social Security was being cut. You know, it was already small enough to begin with. And the very, very early protests were from older people who were then attacked by these in Nicaragua, they call them turbas, or you know, the faithful, some faithful from the Sandinista party, and that really did outrage some of the students, who then came out later, but in very small numbers, to say, how can you do this to our older people? I mean, the ones that are you know, so much more vulnerable in the society. And that was the spark, right? The very first protests were still very small, but what really turned them into the massive kinds of protests that we've seen since April was the repression, the miscalculation that Daniel Ortega made in assuming that if you came out and just beat up a bunch of students and then very forcefully, again, using this, you know, this rhetorical language about how these were very small groups that were just delinquents and they were led by the right wing and you could dismiss them in that way, it didn't work this time. And the outrage the Nicaraguans felt at the fact that the government, that the state would attack its youth in a country where, you know, over 50% of the population is under 15, was maybe the straw that broke the camel's back. And the response of the population at large was immense. And the marches that were have been organized since by all kinds of sectors. Women's sectors in particular have been very, very active in this, in response in part to the fact that one of the ways in which the Danielista government decided to play nice with the church was to really come very hard on the feminist movement.
They passed a strict anti-abortion bill early in his presidency.
Yeah, not only that, but you know, they disarticulated as many of the feminist movements as possible in Nicaragua. It was one of the most vibrant sectors under the neoliberal regimes.
What about the more economically marginal parts of the country, the Afro-Nicaraguan enclaves and indigenous communities along the eastern coast?
I haven't heard much about what's going on, particularly with indigenous people, but the Afro-Caribbean population has been mobilized around the assassination or the murder of one of the journalists that came out to document the very early, I'm forgetting his name, of the very early protest that happened in the Atlantic coast. That was one of the first videos that went viral. And we mustn't forget the role that social media is playing in this is immense and is so important. It's very difficult to get a handle. But this was on the very first days of the protest, there was a journalist that was out on the streets of filming what he was seeing, and he was very close to I believe it was a bank, and he was filming, and then somebody else was filming him, you know, filming the fact that somebody had thrown a rock at the window of a bank, and before you know it, he was shot, and he was shot in the head, and the witnesses that saw him, so you see him get shot on the video, and the witnesses that saw the shooting said that it was a policeman, and that video went viral. I got it maybe within 12 hours of when it happened, and I didn't know what I was seeing because there was no explanation. The explanation came out a few hours later that this had been a journalist, and that has galvanized the population of Afro-Caribbean population.
So we talk about violent repression of the protesters, beatings, murders, and so forth. Are we talking about police? Are we talking about government supporters? Are we talking about paramilitaries? Do we know?
The repression it's clearly government supporters, right? But this is an interesting phenomenon in that the police have not been directly involved except in the very early days, in the very, very early days, and in response of the population's response, you have to stop the repression because that's their number one demand. Daniel Ortega did pull the police back. By the second day, the police were nowhere to be found. So the police in their uniforms have been completely pulled back. It's hard to know then who these mysterious people are that jump out of white trucks and shoot against the populations. There are some targeted, clearly sharpshooters that are involved in this. Most of them are in civilian clothes. It's hard to tell if they are the same people that typically support the regime, if they're part of the youth, you know, armed wing of the Sandinista Party, which they could be, or if they're more sort of classic Latin American paramilitary units.
Some of the medic reports are describing headshots from high angles,
yes,
which suggests snipers on rooftops at a distance, which suggests military training.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which begs the question, where is the military in this? Is it firmly loyal to the Daniel Ortega presidency? Is it an autonomous institutional actor in Nicaragua?
I think that's a really important question that nobody has been talking about. And right now, the military has not been heard from formally. Absolutely. One of the other ways in which Daniel Ortega cemented his own base of power was to remove, again, all the historical Sandinista figures outside of the military. So the military is now run by people that Daniel Ortega himself put in power. But they have remained outside of the fray officially. Daniel Ortega has not called the military out to, for example, dismantle all the barricades or to bring out the tanks or to directly attack the demonstrations. But clearly there is something going on there. And the military has to be thinking both, even though the cúpula or the leadership was put in place by Daniel Ortega, they have to be thinking right now about what decisions they're going to make. Are they going to stay with Daniel Ortega until he falls? Or are they going to try to defend the position that what used to be the Ejército Popular Sandinista won for itself, which was a position of a really non-political army, an army that was professional, an army that was used as an army should be, which is, you know, defense of national sovereignty, not as an army that would attack its own people. So they have to be thinking about this right now, to the degree that you're right, that they have these snipers that are involved, and that you have men in civilian clothes that are attacking the civilian population as they come out to demonstrate. It's hard to tell whether they may be military. They may be ex-military. There's a lot of people in Nicaragua who are ex-military that are no longer a formal part of the institution, right? But the institution itself has remained on the margins. So they're going to, at some point, they may have to decide, do we stick with Daniel Ortega until the end? Or if Daniel Ortega calls out the military against the people, will they decide to go with the people? And then what role will they play in the negotiations that right now have started? They have installed. They have been, right now, Daniel has asked for time to think about the proposals.
Reflection time.
Yes, exactly. You know, reflection time on whether he's going to leave power or not.
This is an initiative that's being championed by Catholic bishops in Nicaragua,
yes,
to try,
yes,
to bring about an end to the conflict. Obviously, one thing that's on the table would be speeding up the elections timetable.
So absolutely.
So there could be a nonviolent resolution to the conflict. Is there any rival political formation in Nicaragua that would be able to take control of government?
I think that's the problem right now. And I think that's the problem that everybody's contending with, right? Because if the elections are scheduled for 2020, one of the demands is that Daniel leave power and that elections are moved up, which maybe if they were moved up a year or whatever. But there is no clear leadership on any part. All the traditional political parties have completely collapsed. They have been disarticulated, you know, under the 3 terms of Daniel Ortega. So there is nobody there that we could say, okay, there's the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party, the traditional parties of Nicaragua. Those don't matter. They really don't exist. They have no leadership. You know, what used to be the former historical Sandinistas, they have not been organized. They have been a voice of opposition throughout the period of time, but they don't have a particular base. They don't have a party because Daniel Ortega pretty much took the entire apparatus of the party. So they are not, there isn't anybody there that you can point to as saying, like, here's the person that might step in. I doubt that Pelas, you know, from the private sector, the largest, single, most important and richest person in Nicaragua right now, who has been at the table for the negotiations, I'm sure he does not interested in politics. He's interested in, you know, just running the economy. So there isn't. That's the problem, right? Because that's where the negotiations hinge. Maybe they'll come to an agreement that they would come up with some kind of council of state. Mm. Nicaragua has been through that one before. So the question would be, and I would imagine that this is some of the maneuvering that's going on right now. It's like, who could be, at this point in time, who could make up this, you know, multi-sectoral group of people that could hold the political power in the country while they organize elections, while they figure out, you know, which parties, what parties would come up and who would run for elections if elections are to be moved up within a year. But there is nobody, right? That's the evil genius, I think, of Daniel Ortega, that he really has been very effective at demobilizing a real political opposition in terms of traditional electoral politics. The students and all the people that are involved in the movement right now is kind of interesting because it reminds me a lot of Occupy. It's in those kinds of sort of more civil society, almost anarchistic, but anarchistic in a good way, of we don't trust the parties,
but
so
not,
we don't want to go that way.
But not a coherent set of demands.
Absolutely not, yeah, a coherent set of demands, and certainly no leadership that we could say this person can run.
Mirna Santiago, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Professor Mirna Santiago teaches Latin American history at St. Mary's College of California, including the history of the Sandinista Revolution.